This is R.J. Rushdoony, Easy Chair number 213, March the 6th, 1990. This evening, Otto Scott and I are going to talk with our Chalcedon Report editor, Gary Mose. Gary returned last night from a trip which took him to Nicaragua and to Hungary, I believe, and Romania. He was accompanied by another of our Chalcedon staff members, Joseph McAuliffe, as well as Douglas Alexander and a friend from Sweden. The purpose of the trip was a relief mission with some funds that he carried from Chalcedon. And we're going to discuss tonight his trip, in particular Romania, which is very, very much in the news, where a very fine reformed group has been making a major stand, in fact, helped precipitate the revolution and now must fight to continue it. Gary, do you want to tell us in general about your trip, and then we can ask specific questions?
Yes, the as you said, the trip began in Nicaragua. I went there for a couple of reasons. One was to observe the work of the Caribbean Christian Ministries program. And secondly, to cover some pre-election stories for a Dutch news agency with whom I'm affiliated. I must say that the people that the Caribbean Christian Ministries has in place in Nicaragua are a very fine group of people doing an excellent work. Pastor Ernan Savory in particular, who's head of the ministry there in Managua, is a very well-educated, very intelligent man, and very dedicated to the Lord and his work. I was privileged to sit in on a seminar he gave to a group of evangelical pastors on the subject of liberation theology, and I was very impressed with his command of the subject and the way in which he responded to liberation theology with a Christian Reconstruction message. It's an excellent work. Pastor Savory is from the Atlantic Coast region, the east coast of Nicaragua, which is a heavily Christianized section of Nicaragua, where the ethnic minorities, the Mosquito Indians, the Creoles, and other people of African descent are located. They were Christianized more than a century ago by the Moravian missionaries, and they still to this day have resisted communism, which the Sandinistas brought into the country, and because of that have been at odds throughout the 10 years with the regime. Had an opportunity to observe the election campaign in progress there, although I had to leave before the election. I was quite impressed with the vigor of the campaign. The people were, ordinary citizens were very much involved in the campaign process, riding through the streets in cars and wearing t-shirts and banners, and there was really quite a very vigorous public participation in the campaign. I was also impressed, I guess, negatively by the hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of international election observers who were there, almost all of whom were, the ones that I met anywhere, were extremely oriented toward the left. And the night before I left, I attended a briefing by a press officer for a group called Witness for Peace. And I was rather amused at the confidence which she displayed toward a Sandinista victory in the election. She just almost totally dismissed any possibility that the UNO coalition could possibly win the election, and accused the UNO group and according to her, the Contras, who supported UNO, which I don't think was exactly accurate, of committing all sorts of irregularities in the campaign. And my investigation was that it was just the opposite. I was able to uncover quite a number of complaints and examples of campaign fraud by the Sandinista side. For example, evangelical Christians in one of the large cities where we visited told me that they probably would not vote in the election out of fear, because the secret agents of the government had personally visited their homes, threatening them with beatings or harm to their families or various other threats if they supported the opposition. They also, yes.
Where did these other observers come from? So we knew that American observers went down there, but where did the others come from?
Well, they were from just about all over the world, quite a number from Western Europe. I met some from Holland, some from Sweden. I don't recall the exact homes of all these people, but my impression was they were from almost all over the world, Canada, Western Europe, and the United States, of course.
UNO must have won by a considerable margin for them to admit defeat.
Yeah, it is. I think the report I saw, it was like a 14% victory margin for UNO, which, considering the climate of the campaign, I think was an overwhelming victory.
There's now a determined press effort to talk it away and
yeah.
to say that UNO is a combination of parties which will break apart, and they've also pointed out that the representation in the parliament, the Congress I think they call it, mm-hmm. is four votes short of what is necessary to change the constitution.
Yes, I believe that's correct. UNO, of course, was a coalition of 14 parties which ranged everywhere from extreme right-wing groups to a couple of the communist parties who were even involved in that. Apparently the thrust of it was a common enemy, even though many of the parties themselves disagreed vigorously with each other. So I think there's a good chance that as a party or as a coalition, well, you could hardly call UNO a party because it represented such a broad spectrum of ideas and ideologies, but it did prove to be an effective coalition in terms of winning an election. Mrs. Chamorro is, I think, admittedly a figurehead. Even her closest supporters characterized her as rather weak in her actual abilities to govern the country. But she is surrounded by some very capable people, and some people that I found to be extremely impressive. One in particular was Gilberto Quadro, who is the president of the Superior Council on Private Enterprises, the main business group in Nicaragua. He is a very impressive man, a very devout Christian, who reads his Bible at the beginning of his workday every day, has two or three Bibles in his office and uses them. I was very impressed with his understanding of the economic situation, his very realistic look at Nicaragua's place in geopolitics and in the economics of the Western Hemisphere. People like him gave me great hope that Nicaragua may indeed have quite a bright future under Mrs. Chamorro.
Do you think these observers all went home after the election? Do you think any of them will remain? You don't know because
I really don't know. I left before the election. Many of the the people who were serving as observers had been there for quite some time. In fact, they were jokingly referred to as sandalistas, the kind of hippie types that have been there for some time, trying their level best to shore up the faltering Sandinista regime.
Well, we've been, they've pretty well clouded reportage from Nicaragua up until this point. And I'm afraid that we have a press curtain regarding the new regime, too.
Yeah, it could be this press officer that I mentioned from Witness for Peace, if she's characteristic of the people who, and I think she is, of the people who were briefing the international press there, and then the press was not getting accurate information. I listened to her for 5 minutes, and I just totally dismissed her as a reliable source of information, although the observers who were listening to her and were soaking up every word.
They took it as what they wanted to hear.
Right. So, you know, when someone like, even like Jimmy Carter says it was the most fair election he had ever observed, he was just completely naive. And,
well, I guess
in addition to the threats,
we could estimate Carter's behavior down there by the amount of praise he's received from our press. I've reached the point where anyone that our press likes, I'm immediately suspicious of.
In addition to the threats of violence against voters in the opposition, I also learned of examples of the Sandinistas buying up voter cards, offering very tempting sums in exchange for voter registration cards. This was done particularly in the Christian section of the country over on the Atlantic coast. They were also in effect bribing people to vote or not to vote, giving children hundreds and hundreds of very nice bicycles. I saw them driving around in the streets offering things like home appliances to people, other very nice rewards to, say, to attend a rally or something. And I also heard that when people did not show up, they went and took back the gifts.
Now, not a word of that, so far as I know, has appeared in the press up here. And yet it was visible.
Yeah, it was very visible. The Sandinistas were very active in the neighborhoods in Managua, where I observed it, perhaps in other cities as well, holding block parties for children with games and races and piñatas and things like that, all-night dances for the young people. So they really went all out. So with that kind of effort and the vastly superior financing they had, it makes the victory for UNO even more stunning.
People took a big risk in voting against them.
Yeah, although UNO made a big point of the fact that the balloting was secret. I saw one large banner hanging over a street that was addressed particularly to military and teachers, reminding them that the balloting was secret. And I think that that did play a large role. The balloting, in fact, was secret. But there were these threats and other irregularities which made it an unfair election, and yet they lost. The bad guys lost, even though they were cheating. The ministry there that I observed, as I said, was very impressive. They're really going out into the villages with a fine educational program of seminars, also with meeting the material needs of the poor people in Nicaragua, and it's an extremely poor country. We've heard this, of course, but I was just astonished at how poor it really was.
It used to be the most prosperous country in Central America.
Yeah, well,
when I was down there just in Somoza's last year and wrote about its economy, it had more land available. The land was available, for instance, for homesteading. You could get a loan from the government and instruction from the government and all the tools you needed to farm. It exported food
yes.
to all parts of the world.
It's just incredible how in 10 years the Sandinistas could have so thoroughly destroyed that country. Just abject poverty. No tools available. Consumer goods are almost non-existent.
They used to have Mercedes automobiles all over the place.
Now the only ones you see are Russian Ladas and a number of other rather funny Eastern European cars. One little East German two-cycle engine, which I've seen in Eastern Europe, was a very funny little car. But that's about all there's there, and they're all falling apart.
I guess our Congress would like to see us improve the same way.
Yeah, I guess. The statistics which Mr. Quadro gave me were just appalling, how in 10 years things could deteriorate so bad. Maybe I could just cite a few of them. According to his figures, the national per capita income was $900 per year in 1978-79. And that's dropped now from 900 to 300. That's just in 10 years.
That's two-thirds.
Yeah. The lowest average wage, the wage for the lowest level of worker, an unskilled entry-level worker, it was about $3 per day in 1978-79. And now even highly regarded professionals, such as teachers, are earning only about $15 a month. So that
what about
a low level of $90 a month now dropped to $15 a month.
What about inflation?
Oh,
did they have a horrendous inflation?
Just incredible. When you enter the country, you're required to exchange $60 in cash for Cordobas, and that $60 that I traded in made me a millionaire. It was over three point six million Cordobas.
Did you take a taxi by any chance, or were you picked up, or what?
And I did not have occasion to ride a taxi, but I did buy a few meals there. And
how much did they cost?
Well, there were three of us that had a very, very fine, very tasty dinner, steak dinner. The three of us together cost, I think, over 800,000 Cordobas.
That would be about $40 or so.
Well, no, that's for three of us. I think that's about $10 or $12. The price is very low, but the inflation.
But in the Cordobas, 800,000.
Yeah, I brought the. It's kind of hard on an audio tape to describe a visual aid here, but I brought an example of their money. This bill that I have in my hand was printed originally to be a 100 Cordoba bill. And because the value changes so rapidly, they haven't bothered to print new money. They just crudely printed right over the old bill, and this 100 Cordoba bill now says 100,000 Cordobas.
100,000.
100,000, yeah.
So that's in 10,000 percent inflation.
Yeah, it's just astonishing.
10,000%.
Cordoba is now trading on the black market there about $72,000 per dollar.
$72,000 per dollar.
I understand that Mrs. Chamorro's...
no wonder they wrote that Dear Comandante letter.
Yeah.
I mean, what's money mean to a Democratic congressman?
Yeah, inflation is just astonishing. We were told not to exchange too much when we came in because even if you stayed like 3 days...
You'd lose
a substantial amount of money. It, you know, changes almost hourly.
I wonder how anybody lives under that circumstance. How does a poor person
live? Well, they don't.
Live?
As a matter of fact, I was told that most families ate one meal a day. They just do not have enough even to buy food for a single day. The way most families are surviving is by sending some member of their family outside the country to earn money and send it back in. That country is taking in about $80 million a year
from relatives
living elsewhere.
That's they've been reduced to beggar.
Yeah, they really have. The only store I saw that was well equipped is one called the Diplo, which is the diplomatic store. And even though officially there's an embargo of American goods, that store was loaded. It was a very bright, modern store. In fact, in several sections of stores, loaded with American goods, strictly American goods.
How do you suppose, Gary, these left Sandinistas could reconcile what they were looking at with their beliefs?
I just can't understand it. They had to be just totally, totally blind. It's got to be spiritual blindness, the only way you can describe it.
It has to be physical blindness, too.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, Shafarovich said that socialism has a will to death to destroy everything, including life.
Well, of course, these are the people who want to snuggle up to the people in power. Mm-hmm. And apparently the infatuation with power. I have run into people through the years who make a practice of traveling to the most begotten parts of the world, the poorest parts of the world, because it makes them feel rich.
Yes.
Do you think there's anything like that involved?
Oh, I'm sure there is, yeah. Particularly the observers that I saw come down would probably fall in that category. They were generally wealthy people.
Wealthy people.
Wealthy people, mm-hmm. or intellectuals. University professors and so on.
Yeah.
Probably financed their own way down. And
mm-hmm.
you know, they firmly believe the ideology which the Sandinistas represent, and so they were just blind to the effects that that ideology causes.
Was the Russian presence minimized at this time because of the election?
Yeah, I was told that that was definitely the case. I happened to notice, was pointed out to us, the Russian compound, living in high style and very fine villas, which belonged to previous landowners. So they're living
all
very well there.
Yes.
Yeah, right. They're living very well. I was told also that a number of Russians and Czechoslovakians and I believe Bulgarians were mentioned. People from several Eastern European countries were invited in. In fact, were hastily given citizenship papers so that they could vote in the election.
Well, their governments haven't recalled those types yet.
No, still there.
So we have this anomaly.
Yes.
The infrastructure in Eastern Europe still seems to be in place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nothing has been done, of course, to separate the Sandinistas from the army nor the secret police.
Yes, as I understand, they still do control the military department and the Department of the Interior, which runs the secret police operation.
Well, I think the official handover is supposed to be in April.
Yeah, there's a very concerted
moment of truth.
Right,
yes.
There's a very concerted effort, demand from the victors that the Sandinistas completely turn over the government.
Sad fact is they have called for the disarmament of the Contras
first.
But not the Sandinistas yet.
Right.
They want
no mention of that.
They want them to disarm and go back. And in fact, former President Carter said that the Contras are the only bloc to complete happiness down there.
Yeah. The Sandinistas may have made a fatal mistake by inviting the Contras to participate in the election process. What they have done, many of them have moved back into the cities, particularly in Managua, and are resettled in the neighborhoods. Managua is kind of an unusual city. It doesn't seem to have a center.
Well, it was not.
It was all destroyed by the earthquakes and never been rebuilt, and so you have a decentralized city, and so what's happening in Managua is happening in the individual neighborhoods. So the Contras have returned to the neighborhoods and have, I guess you might say, re-infiltrated the neighborhoods, which was the tactic that the Sandinistas used in their original takeover, was to infiltrate key neighborhoods, seize control of those, and then move on to the next neighborhood, and they gradually that way took over Managua. And now the Contras are in the same position. And
that's great.
They're not laying down their arms. There are also people in the neighborhoods who have access to weapons, who are actually part of the government. Right next door to the headquarters for Caribbean Christian Ministries, the man living next door was someone who I believe was an educator of some kind who regularly goes out into the countryside on various projects for the government, and whenever people like this go out, they're given weapons, supposedly, to defend themselves against the Contras. But this man definitely is not sympathetic to the government, even though he has a job for the government. So it's people like him who are in neighborhoods and who do have access to weapons.
What about the neighborhood committees, the neighborhood watch?
I just don't know anything about that, so I can't answer that question.
Well, it's too bad you had to leave the day before the election. You must have done a lot of thinking on the flight to Europe as to what the outcome would be.
Yeah.
Did you really think when you saw it all that the Chamorro would win?
Yes, I did.
Oh, you did?
I really did. I was there on the Sunday before the election, and the campaign was to officially wind up on the following Wednesday. But on that Sunday before the election was the last big campaign effort, and the crowd that turned out in Managua for the UNO group was overwhelming. It was an astonishing crowd of, it was estimated everywhere from 40,000 to 400,000, and I would guess it was on the upper side of that. It was a sea of people, and by far the largest outpouring of opposition sentiment that has ever been seen in the 10 years that the Sandinistas have been in power. And the people that I talked to on the reliable sources of information were just completely convinced that there would be an UNO victory. So I left there expecting that would be the case. And it turned out to be so.
You were there alone on that leg of the journey, or was
yes.
any of the men with you?
No.
They joined you
right.
subsequently.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In Amsterdam?
Yes, we all, the four of us were on the team to Eastern Europe, met each other in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
Met first of all with a group which I've mentioned before, the Christian Foundation for Aid to Conscience Convicts, which is located in a small town called Andijk. We received a briefing there on their work and the latest efforts to provide relief to Eastern Europe, particularly to Romania.
So what does that mean? Prisoners of Conscience?
Yeah, that's the name of the organization.
Uh-huh.
Christian Foundation.
Did they go to prisons?
The organization began about 10 years ago. In fact, they're just celebrating their 10th anniversary this year. They began with a campaign to write to prisoners, postcards and letters from Christians in the West to prisoners in the Soviet Union and other Eastern countries. Their basis for their whole ministry is in Matthew 25, where Jesus talks about, at the final judgment of I was in prison and you visited me, and that whole passage. So they have a number of legs to their ministry. The effort to be of encouragement to prisoners was in response to what Christ said about visiting prisoners, and what Christ said about feeding the hungry and giving drink to the thirsty is part of their food supply effort.
This group ministering to prisoners, of course, has been asking people also to write to heads of state, Soviet premier or whatever the country is, so that they know there are people, Christians, who are concerned about the Christians in prison.
That's been very effective. the people who have been persecuted in these countries have been the unknown people for the most part. Those that have become well known or at least identified generally are better off when the leaders in those countries have known that the West knows. It's been gone much better for them. So this has been a very important ministry to not only to encourage those who have been in prison, but to, as you say, let the authorities know that we know what they've been doing.
Has there been any change in the condition of the prisoners in Romania?
Yes, there definitely is change in Romania, no doubt about it. Where there is not change, I think, would be in the economic area. It's been just a very short time since the revolution, and there is virtually no government right now in Romania. Those who are in government positions, from my observation, are doing nothing more than crisis management. People are beating the doorstep down with needs, with demands. People are coming in asking for housing. In the city of Arad, for example, where we spent most of our time, they have 10,000 requests for housing and only 100 dwellings available.
Well, where are they living?
Living with relatives or sometimes in the streets or in the countryside.
In the streets?
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty cold. It's still winter, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Although it has been unseasonably warm, though. Just as we left, a storm moved across Europe and it got quite cold again, but definitely is not a pleasant place to be.
What are they using for money?
They still use the lei, the
Is anything
currency.
Working? The factories working?
Yes.
The trains running?
Well, they have been working for 40 years now. And
they have no trains.
They have trains, but they're very old, very rickety, often do not have any glass in the windows.
What about
From appearances, economically, I would say there's no difference. I was told that some of the necessities of life, the staple foods, for example, oil and butter and flour, are now available in the store, whereas they were not before. So some of the very basic necessities.
You traveled by car, didn't you?
Yes.
Where did you get your gasoline? They have stations.
Well, you just don't make sure you don't run out. You don't go deep enough into the country to run out of gas.
Well,
they do have stations.
Refill?
There are gas stations, but just as before, the lines are miles long. Every gas station, I would say at least 2 miles of cars lined up, sometimes two and three.
How many gallons you could get, or liters?
Yeah. Well, yeah, for the ordinary people, the residents of Romania, that's the case. Western visitors can buy coupons at the border and in the special dollar shops, they call them.
You can
buy a coupon. Yeah, if it's available.
Mm-hmm.
And the price is extremely high.
How much?
Oh, $13-$15 a gallon.
$15 a gallon. Oh, you ought to tell Ralph Nader. You ought to tell Ralph Nader about this. I mean, we've got some environmentalists here who would like to hear this.
Yeah.
That's
they
what
might
they would
favor
like.
It.
That's
yes.
what I'm saying. They would like it. Yes.
Yeah.
So everybody can walk.
Yeah. I was told more gasoline was available, but from the lines I saw, I have a hard time believing it. Sometimes
$15 a gallon.
Yeah. Sometimes three and four abreast for a mile or two, cars would be lined up. That's the same way it was 5 years ago when I made my first trip there. So, like I say, economically there's been almost no improvement. Where there has been improvement is in the area of the fear.
There's less fear?
Less fear. No fear at all, I would say.
No
at this
fear
point.
At all.
Whereas before, people lived in constant fear and terrible despair over the outrageous oppression which I've previously described and which now is quite well known in the world. Now the people feel very free.
The reports that have been coming to me have been that there is a radical moral collapse that was probably there before and is more evident now. And apart from the Christian community, things look rather bleak. How is the Christian community meeting this situation?
Well, you're quite right. The Christian community has been the stabilizing factor, even during the years of Ceausescu. People recognize that, and people who were not Christians would often adhere to the Christian community just because they were that stabilizing factor. They were really, in a very real sense, were the salt of Romanian society. Christians now have become very active, I'm pleased to say, not only in evangelism, which they can now do openly, and in preaching the gospel in their churches, but are also very active in attempting to reconstruct their society. And the city of Arad I was just astonished at what had happened there. That city, and it's also the same name, Arad, is a district, or you might, comparable to our state here in the United States. The government of that province is completely Christian, from the president of the province.
How did that happen under the communists?
Well, when the revolution broke out in Timisoara, one Christian man, a father, who's an actor, actually, father of, I think he said, five children, became very concerned when he heard that the army at that point and the secret police were killing people right and left, including children, and he vowed that if that moved over into his city, Arad, that he would want to be in the forefront of resisting that effort. And when, in fact, it did come to Arad, he did step forward and led the population of Arad in resisting the security forces. And because he just stepped forward in front of the crowd said, okay, you're the leader.
So this is the new governor.
This is the new government.
The new administration.
The new administration. All the old guys are out.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a completely new administration there now, and it's thoroughly Christian, from the president, who I just described, and all of his advisors and all the key leaders in the city are Christians.
Well, could you tell me something? Did you see any stores?
Stores, yeah.
Hotels?
Believe me, I stayed in a hotel, and that's where I was robbed, right in my hotel room. The hotel we stayed in, as all hotels are, they're very pathetic. The windows were full of bullet holes. In fact, the room of the door we stayed in had a bullet hole through it, and on the wall on the inside, the bullet was lodged in the wall yet.
So. Mm-hmm.
So there was very, very heavy
fighting. Well, who owned the hotel? Who owns these stores? I understood that the state owned everything.
Yeah.
The state still owns everything.
Yes. There are now private taxis. That's the first.
Private taxis. That's the first that disappeared.
Private enterprises.
Somebody with a car has decided to operate as a taxi.
Right. And they're authorized now.
Oh, they're authorized. Private. So they even have a license even now.
Right. And there has been, in the countryside, some land has been given to the peasants, so there is some privately owned land now. And there's an effort to return some of the government land to people. So there's hope for private enterprise.
To persons from whom it was confiscated, or from somebody who was lucky enough to get there first in line?
I don't know if anybody's figured that out yet. It's been 50 years.
Knowing somebody who maybe could turn it over?
I think in the case of the peasants that I was told about, it's people who were working that particular land.
Who were working it anyway, for the state.
Now own it. Yeah.
The Reformed Church there, of course, was the source of the revolutionary impetus.
Right. That's an interesting thing. There is very definitely an ethnic problem in Romania, as there seems to be throughout Eastern Europe. And the Reformed Church is a Hungarian church.
Mm-hmm.
And the Romanian people were very impressed by the fact that it was the Hungarians, who many of them do not like, were the ones who led their country to freedom. And they recognized, of course, that it was not only Hungarians, but it was Hungarian Christians So there's a tremendous new respect among the the Romanian population for the Hungarian Christians. Pastor Laszlo Tokes, who was the Hungarian pastor in Timisoara, who led the revolution,
yes,
is now just a giant of a character in Romania. He's a hero of heroes. Painted on the wall outside of his church office is a sign that says "Long Live Laszlo Tokes."
And, did you see him by any chance?
Yes, so he did. We were able to meet with him very briefly. He's an extremely busy man, has a tremendous appointment schedule, and there were reporters from all over the world trying to get interviews with him. We managed to get one for about 5 minutes, which I have on videotape. He is an impressive character, very soft-spoken, self-effacing, calls himself a complete newcomer to politics and doesn't even really want to be in politics, although he did admit he was considering whether he would run for national office, and we'll make a decision on that soon. I received various reports about him and about the faction in the Reformed Church that he represents. When I was in Hungary, we met with the leader of a Reformed college in a city called Debrecen, an old college that dates back to the Reformation, has been in existence since that time. The group that's affiliated with this college characterizes itself as the evangelical element within the Hungarian Reformed Church. Although Doug Alexander, who was with me, thought he detected some Barthian philosophy in this group. The man I talked to from that group described Laszlo Tokes and other elements in the Hungarian Reformed Church as traditionalists and cultural Christians. And I would have to say in the brief interview I had with him that there may be some substance to that. Although he was described as being completely an unspiritual man, I don't think that's the case. It appeared that his interest was perhaps as much cultural as it was religious. When we asked him, you know, how his faith influenced his work in society, his political standing right now, he said, well, of course, as a pastor and as a Christian, the Word of God informs him, but he did not believe it was possible or necessarily even right to try to directly implement biblical teachings in politics and in government. So, as I say, it was a very short interview and perhaps inconclusive in determining what his actual beliefs are with regard to what we would call Christian Reconstruction. But he is clearly a Christian. In fact, I was told that at one of his recent trips to Hungary for a speaking engagement, his bodyguard, who is a soldier in the Romanian army, went with him, and he led that soldier to Christ. The soldier himself testified to that fact. So I believe he definitely is a Christian. As to the depths of his faith, I just can't say.
Or how the faith interworks with the social
structure. Right, right.
It sounds, from your description, pretty much like the upset landscape that I recall at the close of World War II, in which everything was more or less up for grabs.
Yes.
Nobody knew anything, and people were bartering all over the place, making deals for food and this and that and so forth.
That's exactly. You've described Romania today just very perfectly. As I said before, there's
the
no government.
The aftermath of the war.
Ceausescu, when he died, or when he was killed, left a complete vacuum in every way. Socially, politically, economically, and since he personally controlled everything in that country, in a very literal sense, there's just no one there who's equipped to deal with anything. So There is no government. There is no social structure. There's no infrastructure. It's all completely deteriorated. It's a country that's in complete chaos. And anyone who steps forward with half a brain or an idea...
Our money.
Our money. Very few have that.
Mm-hmm.
Is by default a leader.
Were there many foreigners? Did you see other Americans by any chance?
No. There are quite a few foreigners in the country now, but that's because of the massive relief effort. Mm-hmm. As we traveled across Europe, I think we didn't make a specific count, but I dare say we saw 200 to 300 to maybe 500 trucks with Red Cross signs on them. From the European community, from the Red Cross, the Hungarian Red Cross, and any number of private relief agencies.
From the west to the east.
Yeah, convoys of trucks, long convoys, sometimes 20, 25 trucks in a convoy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see them all over the place in Romania. So there's been a massive effort. The organization that we went with alone has sent 80 trucks of relief goods since Christmas.
From Amsterdam?
From Amsterdam, yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, I listened to Paul Weyrich a few weeks ago, who has led a team over to those countries, and he's giving them seminars on how to conduct elections and how to campaign. And he said in his talk that they needed instruction on how to democratize. And since you... When you stop to think about this, the staggering effrontery of that, because most of those countries had parliaments and democratic institutions 1,000 years ago.
Most of them did, but Romania is the exception there.
Romania was the exception.
They do not have a democratic tradition there, and they're the first to admit it. This young Christian president of Arad County told me that, in fact, he begged. He said, we need help. We do not know what democracy means. We do not know anything.
I'm not sure we know what it means here.
Yeah, that may be the case. But he begged. And he was very specific in saying, what I need is Christians. He told me he would not listen to anyone who was not a Christian. He just could not trust anyone from the West who is not a Christian. And he insists that any advice he gets is going to have to come from Christians.
Recently, I was... looking through a bound volume of a news periodical from the 20s, and it was ironic because there was Romania, King Carol.
Oh yes,
and Magda Lupescu, his mistress.
Yes,
and all the talk which made Romania Playboy's paradise in those days.
Yeah, he called his
money
yacht Lucifer.
Well, Ceaușescu
had lots of oil.
Yes, very wealthy.
Romania oil fields are really the biggest elephant pits in Europe.
Yes, has tremendous oil reserves, all kinds of minerals, gold and silver in the Carpathian Mountains, and agriculturally, it could be a very rich country. The management of agriculture under the communists is a disaster, of course, but at one time, I believe, Romania was very much a breadbasket for us.
The communists took one of the wealthiest centers of Europe and turned it into a horror. With their policies.
Well, of course, they still have, Russia still has, Soviet Union still has these countries tied up on paper for their commodities.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those countries are now talking about trading with the West, but they're still under contract to the Kremlin.
Yeah.
How about Hungary?
Hungary, I've been going there off and on for 5 years now, and in each of my trips I notice a remarkable, noticeable improvement in the economic situation. They've been toying with capitalism now for almost 10 years, and the contrast between Romania and Hungary is just astonishing. from a material standpoint, Hungary is pretty much now another European country, not anywhere near, say, West Germany or anything like that, but there are, the shops are, and even the large stores are full of goods. Western interests are in there, the large hotels, the Hilton hotels and so on. Budapest is another European capital. People are well dressed.
There must be a real race underway on corporate levels to get into some of those countries.
I think so. Mm-hmm. There's just vast opportunities there. Prices are very low in Hungary. Mm-hmm. So it's a good place even to vacation at this point. We stayed in a very, very nice hotel in Budapest for only $18 a night. So. Mm. On the other hand, the downside of it is the Hungarians have used their newfound freedom in kind of a libertine way, adopting all the worst aspects of Western culture. Pornography is just absolutely rampant everywhere you turn, everywhere you look, you see examples of it. The occult is very strong. It's a country that has been totally secularized, and it's an atheistic country in every way, and so it's not a pretty sight morally, but economically mm-hmm. they're progressing.
Budapest is now exercising quite an appeal to the jet set as a place to go for fun and games, where anything goes.
Hilton Hotel, for example, has just opened a new casino there, so they have casino gambling in Budapest, so I can see that.
So it's
exotic in a way.
It's a post-war element, really.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's
because,
way
you know, this is
it.
What attends the end of the Great mm-hmm. War.
Yeah.
Is total abandon.
Yeah.
We're alive, let's celebrate, and so forth.
It was this
There's
tremendous pent up,
a cynicism which emerges.
That's true. And a despair that comes with that too. Hungary has one of the highest suicide rates in the world. If not the highest.
More than Sweden.
Higher than Sweden, even.
Higher than Sweden. There's something in the little items appearing in the press to the effect that the Eastern Europeans, intellectuals, are going to Sweden and Scandia generally because they can't quite make the transition into capitalism as though it exists. I mean, let's be fair. Yeah. There is no capitalism anywhere. We have a mixed economy here, very similar to, not to the extent of Sweden, but not too far from it. So there, these Eastern European intellectuals, according to the press, are looking at Scandia as a pattern.
Yeah, you hear that very often there. The Swedish model is being put forward as the model for Eastern Europe, and this is a disaster. The Swedish model, just in the past month, has badly deteriorated. The Swedish economy is in very sad shape right now, and mm-hmm. the last easy chair that I visited with you, I think I mentioned signs of cracking in the Swedish economy, and since we had that discussion, there's been quite a bit of press in Europe about that fact. In fact, the British Economist magazine this week has a special, about a 20-page special section on the crash of the Swedish model.
Well, Sweden has had a favored position among nations because it has not had a war since the Napoleonic era. Mm-hmm. And has had to spend very little money on defense. And in every war, it has sold heavily to both sides. Yeah. So it has been highly prospered by wars. But it's burned up all of that now, and
it's
near the end of its
life. It's used up all of its capital along mm-hmm. that line, and all of its moral capital, and what little religious capital it had left, which was the foundation, of course, for the very bright economy that Sweden once had.
Well, it's interesting. I saw a comment, I think it's in this commentary, to the effect that the 18th century ended in 1789 with the French Revolution. The 19th century ended effectively in 1914.
Yes.
And it could very well be that the 20th century has ended with the collapse of the socialist regimes in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken people quite a little while to adjust to this sudden reversal.
The sad thing is that when you see a country that had the base that Sweden had its own model now collapsing, its economy is in a very bad shape, but that now being used as the model for these
that's
terrible countries in Eastern Europe.
The intellectuals there don't want to turn around and say we've been totally wrong.
Right.
It's
never going to work in these countries, and that's the sad part.
Our time is almost up. Gary, do you want to make a summary statement about the trip?
I'll just avoid the summary, and I just wanted to tell you one other thing about Romania that just really touched me while I was there, and that is the spirit of forgiveness that I saw among the Christians. A young pastor that I have written about and talked about, Doru Popa, who for years was persecuted, even up until just the time of the revolution, was arrested and in prison. I went with him to the police station. He helped me out with my theft in the hotel room there, and after we left the police station, he was talking to a policeman in a very friendly way, and after we left, he turned to me and said that that man had been the chief of police up until the revolution and was in fact the man who had arrested him and had accused him of being a parasite and had harassed him and caused all kinds of problems for him. And now, after the revolution, this young pastor is now the chairman of the Human Rights Council in Iran and has a very high government position, and he went back to this former police chief and asked him, "Now do you think I'm a parasite?" And the man said, "No, I never thought you were. It was the Communist Party officials who made me do what I did to you." But the attitude that this young pastor had to the man who had been his enemy and done him great harm was just the most beautiful example of forgiveness that I had ever seen. Another very astonishing example was a church in the city of Medias had received a food shipment from the group in Holland, and when they got their food allotment from them, their pastor told them to go into their streets of their neighborhood and share the food with the people who had spied on them before. And they did, and the neighbors broke down in tears and were on their knees in the streets in front of these Christians who shared their substance with those who had been their enemies.
Well, thank you, Gary, and thank you all for listening.